Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In Psalm 24, it is written, "The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof." This is one of many reminders throughout the Bible that God has created this world, and that we humans, being created by God as well, need to be thankful for His creation and take good care of it. Over the past several decades, as issues of pollution, climate change, and resource depletion have moved to center stage in our public discourse, many religious groups have become increasingly interested in emphasizing the role that faith plays in environmental stewardship. It just so happens that I too, being the outdoor enthusiast that I am, have a strong interest in conservation and closely follow developments in environmental research, economics, and politics. And so recently, when I stumbled upon an article about how a faith-based organization was combining a religious mission with environmental leadership, and doing so in a way that sought to leverage what we know about markets and economics, I was so excited that I knew I had to get the director of this program on our podcast. The organization is called Green Faith, and I read about it in a publication from the Property and Environmental Research Center in Bozeman, Montana, which happens to be one of my favorite think tanks. Green Faith, one of the oldest religious environmental organizations in the U.S. and located in Highland Park, New Jersey, is headed up by Reverend Fletcher Harper, who joins us today to talk about this rather interesting enterprise. Reverend Harper is an Episcopal priest and an award-winning spiritual writer and nationally recognized preacher on the environment. He is a graduate of Princeton University and the Union Theological Seminary, and served as a parish priest for 10 years as well as taking on leadership positions in the Episcopal Church before becoming Green Faith's executive director in 2002. We will link to Green Faith's website, www.greenfaith.org, so if you're interested in what they are doing, please drop by our website, www.researchonreligion.org, and click on over to theirs. Fletcher, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Before we get started in talking about your organization, Green Faith, I want to explore a little bit of your personal background, if I could, starting with why you entered the ministry, and more importantly, for purposes of this podcast, what motivated you to take your ministry in the direction of environmental stewardship? Because, you know, I thought clergy were just supposed to marry people and hand out communion wafers on Sunday. So what gives here?
Well, that's what we do for the most part, and then we've got 6 days of the week off, is what the joke goes.
Yeah.
No, I, from a relatively early age, was one of those people for whom religion and spirituality and a sense of the sacred was important. But I was interested in writing. I thought seriously about being a journalist after college, and I actually did an independent journalism project for 1 year out of college. A sort of triggering event for me was that very unexpectedly my father died when I was 21 years old. And that sort of took me out of a stage of my life where I'd been having an awful lot of fun and not as much serious thinking into a sort of new stage where I was looking at sort of what was my life going to be about and what was most important. And formal religious leadership started to become more and more something that appealed to me. The heroes that I had who were largely social activists in the public sphere had all done their work for clearly religious and moral motivations. And so I went to seminary and was a parish priest for 10 years, which I really enjoyed, but I always had this sense at the back of my mind that my ministry, my religious leadership was going to be focused on public issues.
You mentioned that some of your heroes were social activists and combined it with their ministry. Could you give us some names of people that you looked up to, say, around your late teens, early 20s?
Sure. It would be a lot of folks in the sort of general liberal pantheon of leaders, sort of Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln, Mahatma Gandhi, Among some, I had a real admiration in certain ways for some stuff that Dorothy Day did with the Catholic worker movement. So a range of different, range of different leaders in that regard. And the sort of intersection with the environment emerged because, I am an outdoorsman and have always, for all of my life, enjoyed being outdoors. My dad and I did a fair amount of fishing together, which was a really important part of our relationship. And I consistently had a sense, even before I could give words to it, that there was something really special about being outdoors, that there was a sort of sense of aliveness and a sense of vitality that I didn't get anywhere else. And I think that's true for an awful lot of people, that time outdoors is just incredibly important, whether you're a religious person or not. It's a fundamental part of being a human being, I think. So,
yeah, I would agree with that entirely. Did you grow up in New Jersey, or where'd you grow up?
No, I grew up in New York making fun of New Jersey, and then ended up out here 20 years ago. But I grew up in New York, and my mother's family lived about an hour north of New York City, and so we spent a lot of time up in northern Westchester County, which is where I got a lot of my early outdoor exposure. It was before the days of suburban sprawl, and things had, you know, there was still quite a lot of open space, and there were lots of places to explore outdoors. And then, fishing with my dad in Rhode Island in the summertime and things like that. So, I camp now a fair amount myself when I can. I take my kids camping. It's been a real gift. It is a real gift.
Now, did you grow up in a religious household, or was it your late teens, early 20s after your father died was a big change in your life?
We were regular churchgoers. I never attended Sunday school because I was one of those kids that thought that the adult sermon was more interesting than Sunday school. So I sort of sat in on the adult portion of the service that way. I wouldn't call my family sort of ardently religious, but it was an important part of our life. Also, I mean, another piece that I'd mention is that my dad was very actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and while that's not a formally religious program, I think an awful lot of people have an appreciation of the way in which that program helps people sort of grow spiritually and morally in some really important ways. And so that was part of our sort of family experience also, was his involvement and leadership with that. So, in one way or another, I did have exposure to religion, both in a formal sense and also in a less formal but equally meaningful sense.
Okay, so you grew up in New York making fun of New Jersey. Ironically, you attend Princeton University then.
Right.
And you go through Union Theological Seminary, and so you're working as a priest and then take leadership roles in the Episcopal Church. What were you doing in terms of your leadership roles with the Episcopal Church?
I helped run the ordination process for Episcopal clergy in the northern part of New Jersey in the greater New York area. And that was a fairly significant involvement. I was the editor, and this was where I won some writing awards for the Episcopal newspaper for the northern part of New Jersey. And then I also represented, I was one of the deputies to the National Episcopal Church Convention and was involved on a national level in that way. So, a number of different things, both at the parish level and then also regionally and nationally.
So then what brings you to Green Faith?
I had been, searching around for the next church that I was going to pastor. I had been at a church in northern New Jersey for about 7 years, and I felt that that God was calling me to the sort of next step forward in my vocation. And I started looking around at different churches, and the search just wasn't going anywhere. I just wasn't finding something that fit. And then I heard about Green Faith, which wasn't called Green Faith at the time. The original name was Partners for Environmental Quality. And I got involved as a volunteer very quickly, and did a certain amount of preaching on the religious obligation to take care of the environment, and got involved in efforts to promote the use of renewable energy by households within our congregation and other congregations. New Jersey had, this was back in the late 90s, had recently deregulated its electricity supply market, and so all of a sudden people had the opportunity for the first time to purchase energy that was generated by a renewable source. And so we thought that promoting that was something that was important, and we went to, I went to, did some work on that. And unbeknownst to me, the organization was starting to look for a new leader. And I was approached about that and had never thought about taking my ministry in that direction. But I went home and thought about it and sat down and started to write an imaginary job description for myself. And I wrote for about 10 minutes, and it was right there. It was a real sort of experience of it was a real gift, and it was a real synthesis of a lot of things that I care about. That opportunity for public religious leadership that I mentioned earlier on, an important social issue, and also a very explicitly religious approach to that. So a lot of things came together, and that was a gift, and I had done my work to be ready to respond, and that's how it got started back in 2002 for me.
Well, you mentioned that you like the explicit faith-based aspect of this, but you also mentioned that this organization was initially called Partners for Environmental Quality. That doesn't have a really religious-y tone to it. It doesn't sound like it would attract a clergy member looking for a new parish to be at. So how did you stumble upon it?
I had seen an email. A friend of mine was one of the original board members of the organization and had sent an email around to clergy colleagues of his, noting that he was involved in this organization that was a faith-based group, even though it didn't have a faith-based name. And so it was a word-of-mouth thing that I heard about in that regard.
Well, tell me a little bit about the history. Now, again, you're getting involved in this in about a decade or so, a little bit more than a decade ago, but it has its roots dating back to the early 90s. So how did this thing come about?
My friend that I just mentioned a moment ago, Reverend Skip Vilas, who's another Episcopal priest, had a clear sense that there needed to be some kind of religious voice speaking on issues of the environment, because clearly the environment was a topic of enormous significance, and religious institutions, frankly, had really missed the boat to a large degree, had not done very much either on a sort of theological educational level or on a practical level or on the level of policy advocacy. So there was a real gap, and Skip attended the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, the UN-sponsored meeting in Rio, and sort of all of a sudden realized that he felt it was important for there to be some sort of religious voice on these issues. And so he came back and spoke to some friends, and that was how the organization got started, on an all-volunteer basis at first, where in the early days, back in the early 90s, there really wasn't a whole lot of material out there about what does the Bible teach about the environment, what are some basic theological teachings on the environment. As simple as some of that stuff may seem, it wasn't on people's radar screens to a large degree. And so for the first several years, what the group did was, different members of the group sort of took turns going to each other's congregations and offering educational forums about their thinking about, what does the Bible teach? What do sacred writings teach? What do, what are some of the theological pieces of real importance here? And so the early stage was really just trying to develop a sense of what was a way of articulating this from a genuinely religious perspective.
Let me stop you right there and ask, just go on a little bit theological tangent here, because when I was setting up this interview, I said, okay, I got to pick up my Bible and start perusing through it. I actually did it on the internet because it's easier to search, looking for environmental passages. And there is nothing out there in the New Testament or the Old Testament that says, ye shall clean up your nuclear waste or dispose it very deep within a Nevada desert. Where do you pull, from the most part, from my reading of the Bible, it's basically God gave us the earth and, hey, you better take care of it. What theological underpinnings was Skip and you and other folks pulling from when you're going around to different parishes and saying, hey, we got to connect our biblical understandings with the environment?
When we think about this stuff, we think about three core sort of underpinnings, which we call spirit, stewardship, and justice. So, just a brief piece about each. With the spirit piece, what we mean by that is what you and I were alluding to earlier on, which is that a vast majority of people have experiences which they would classify as spiritual experiences or deeply meaningful experiences outdoors. a sort of fancier way of saying it is that the natural world serves as a source of divine revelation. It reveals God to us in one way or another, either through its beauty or its majesty, or through the wonder and awe or the mystery we experience at its, at the mere fact that the earth exists and our place within it. So there's a what we call spirit as sort of one dimension. Another theme is the theme of stewardship, which is the obvious one that you get when you look at the first chapter of Genesis, when, you know, God creates the earth and gives human beings dominion. And a lot of people are not comfortable with that passage because they think that it's the same, it means the same as exploitation, and it clearly doesn't. What that statement is in many ways is a statement of fact. You know, whether we think it's right or not, we've got dominion. We influence the planet, we manage it in an awful lot of ways, and we're accountable for that management or that stewardship and making sure that it leaves the earth in at least as good condition as we've inherited it. And then the third theme is justice, which is that religious traditions have a broad consensus that we need to work to protect the dignity of the most vulnerable people and the most vulnerable among us within society. And that has been engaged by religious communities for millennia in regards to issues like hunger. But also we think that relates to the environment, where clearly you've got the data on that shows that while everybody suffers from pollution, the communities that suffer its worst impacts are communities of color and low income communities in the U.S., for instance. So that's the sort of values basis. And there are also other theological themes. I mean, when we talk, for instance, with our evangelical Christian brothers and sisters about these topics, issues like the Second Coming and its implications for an environmental worldview start to emerge, because the sort of common thinking is that if what the Second Coming represents is a mass exodus by Christians who are saved from the earth so that God can then destroy the earth, that doesn't seem to imply any long-term value in God's eyes for the natural world. And what we do is work with biblical text to show that there's actually a very different witness within the New Testament in regards to that. So there are some broad themes, and then there are specific teachings and texts that different traditions emphasize. But I think those themes are a reliable guide.
Let me ask you about that, as you mentioned, going to evangelicals who've often been accused of focusing their attention otherworldly and not concerning themselves with the things in the here and now. How did members of different spiritual communities react to the creation of this organization in its early startup time? I mean, with Skip doing that, if you had some conversations with him and he said, hey, you know, boy, everybody signed on right away, or there was a lot of skepticism. What was the reception?
Early on, you know, I would say from the early to the late 90s and even into the early 2000s, the real battle was the battle for sort of conceptual legitimacy, if you will, sort of making the case to people that the environment was a legitimate topic of religious engagement and religious attention and religious concern. And, you know, I would say that in a number of cases, the mainline Protestant, mainline Jewish, sort of liberal Roman Catholic communities were the ones that were initially most receptive, at least on a conceptual level. But there were also any number of evangelical leaders from that point in time in the early 90s who recognized that this was important. I mean, there's a tremendously important evangelical scholar named Cal DeWitt, who's been writing about this stuff for quite a long time. And he's a scientist, but he's also very biblically literate and was able to make the case on from both vantage points. So I think that, you know, there was an initial battle for legitimacy, and there also was a certain amount of suspicion among more theologically conservative communities for the very understandable reason that they equate environmentalism with left-wing politics and left-wing culture, and if they're on the conservative end of the spectrum, it's very understandable that they're going to have some suspicion about that. I think there's also a really interesting, within American history, there is this sort of sort of nature spirituality that has been part of American religious and cultural history for a while, where you've got the Transcendentalist movement and the Hudson River School of Painting, where there is a sort of a certain kind of romanticizing of the natural world. And I use that term, sort of well aware that it's got a number of different dimensions to it. But, the issue of the environment raises really interesting questions for religion. To some degree, all religions are supposed to revolve around their deity or around their God. But for an awful lot of religions, it becomes very easy for the primary focus to be on human well-being alone. And obviously, from an environmental perspective, that's an inadequate or incomplete view of the universe.
Now, another player in this whole environmental movement, and this dates back even further back to the 1960s, early 70s, with the creation of Earth Day, which we're coming up to, by the way, here in late April, was the secular movement. And you mentioned earlier on that when religious folks start talking about Genesis 1 and the dominion that humanity's been given over the earth, people get spooked by that. They see that as exploitation. Did you experience, or did Skip or anybody experience, some resistance from the secular environmental community about what you guys were doing? They look at you a little bit askance.
Yeah, and I think, I don't want to make it an overly simplistic answer, but I think that there are a lot of secular liberal individuals and organizations that have a very healthy suspicion of organized religion. And I can understand that to some degree. I mean, some of the reasons are good. Organized religion is an extremely human institution, and it is absolutely far from perfect, and has caused real harm. I obviously, having given my life to it, also believe it's created an awful lot of good, and there is, and within the sort of liberal sector of society, you've got a sort of higher level of secularism often than in the more moderate and conservative sectors of society. So, there was some real suspicion at first. And then I think the second thing that we saw was, once environmental organizations started recognizing that these religious groups actually represented a fairly large network in one way or another, their first instinct was to seek to mobilize that network on behalf of political advocacy. And in some cases, I can understand that completely, but I'm not sure that it led to the kind of long-term relationship building that would have been smartest in many ways on the part of mainstream environmental groups. There was some suspicion at first, and then some opportunism in terms of trying to make use. And more recently, there've been, I think the conversation has become more sophisticated as there have been more religious leaders and religious groups starting to pay attention to the environment in a significant way. So I think it's an evolving history.
Let me explore a statement that you made just a moment ago, where you said that a number of secular groups saw that religions offer a great network. And throughout history, religious organizations have been wonderful at fomenting collective action. So it is if you want to organize people, it's a great place to go. But you said that some of these secular groups didn't perhaps take the right strategy, or there were some difficulties in connecting up. Explain what you meant by that a little bit more.
Well, I think that the main piece is that in more recent decades, the portion of the environmental movement that has gotten the most attention has been the legislative advocacy piece of the picture, and in a lot of people's minds, that's what it means to be an environmentalist, is to be someone who is a political activist, usually on the left, seeking greater regulation of the business sector, usually. I'm not saying that I disagree with that, but I am saying that is not the full picture of what it means, and that also, by definition, alienates a significant piece of the population. And I think that, part of the importance of the sort of developing relationship between religious groups and environmental groups is is, for religious groups to be able to exert influence on cultural development to encourage greater respect for the natural world in a manner that, you know, we hope becomes hardwired into the culture so that you get more people taking care of the environment in a manner that they are motivated to by what they believe to be, by what they believe to be true, as opposed to a more sort of command and control kind of approach, which, as you know, is often more resource intensive to make happen. So I'm not sure if that gets at what you were saying, but that sort of is part of how we've seen it.
Now that is a really interesting insight, and I hadn't thought about that connection before. We are going to be talking about what you've done with PERC out in Bozeman, Montana a little bit, but I still want to explore a little bit what Green Faith is doing. So we're still in the 1990s here. The movement is starting to going mostly a volunteer organization. What things was the organization focused on at that time? Were you doing, you mentioned you were going around to different parishes and there's some religious education, but was there any other types of outreach efforts or programs that you were implementing?
The work that that we got focused on, fairly quickly when I came on board was in a couple of different areas. One was we started doing working on issues of energy conservation in religious institutions because we knew that there were very substantial opportunities for financial savings as well as for environmental benefits in doing energy conservation work in those sites. And we knew that that was going to be an important and useful motivator in terms of broaching the topic. It was a way that we could create benefits for these institutions as well as asking them to preach and teach about encouraging people to do the right thing by the environment. So we got ourselves through working with a very experienced energy auditor of religious facilities, a wonderful guy named Andy Rudin. We got some experience doing energy audits of faith-based sites with him and began to work on that as one area of activity. We did a lot of preaching and getting out to various to synagogues, to churches, to mosques, to temples, to faith-based schools, and sort of building up our experience in terms of articulating the basis in theology, the basis in sacred text for this. We started organizing what we called environmental justice tours, where working with some local leaders in Newark, New Jersey, we would take people on tours to see different contaminated sites. And what we found was that when people sort of got out of the tour bus and saw the contaminated site, buried behind a chain link fence and heard about what was buried underground and the impact that has on the health of a community, and then they turned around and they saw the housing project or the school right down the street, all of a sudden it took these issues from being sort of abstract political issues to being issues about people suffering and the need to avoid that, because that's, again, a teaching that's common to the world's great religions is helping avoid avoidable suffering or prevent it. So we did environmental justice tours, and then as we gained more and more experience, we realized that there were a growing number of clergy and lay leaders around the country who wanted to focus on these issues, but they didn't have anywhere to go to get some education and training on these things. They didn't have any community of support to work with. And so we created our fellowship program as our first sort of major national program through which we invited, we created an 18-month curriculum, which involved three retreats of 4 days apiece in the greater New Jersey area and monthly webinars. Every fellow would write their own eco-theological statement to base what they believed in their own tradition as well as in their own experience. Every fellow would create a leadership project of some kind in their own setting. So we had some fellows organizing zero waste events at church potlucks in the Denver area. We had fellows doing, writing series of op-ed pieces. We had, a couple of fellows went out and wrote books. We had one fellow who did a collection of music for Roman Catholic settings focused on environmental themes and Catholic liturgy. A whole range. We had fellows leading retreats outdoors where people would go out and speak about their experiences of God outdoors and identify passages from the Bible that spoke to them in regards to those. So a whole range of different types of projects, all sort of under the broader rubric of putting out these tentacles to sort of look at what are different manifestations of religious action on the environment. So that was sort of, the early stuff was trying a lot of different things, and then once we had tried a number of different things, bringing folks together to share that and to try to teach and learn about how could religious groups become more effective in our specific ways around reaching people on the environment.
So what I'm hearing is that this thing that started as an Episcopalian environmental volunteer group is now becoming a larger ecumenical organization that expanded from New Jersey across the United States, correct?
Yes, that's correct. We started as an interfaith group,
okay.
But we started also with a New Jersey focus, and it just became clear over the years that we were doing things that from what we could tell, no other group was doing specifically. I mean, there were other groups doing policy advocacy on the environment, and they've done that for a while now, but there wasn't any other group out there that had this kind of holistic approach. I mean, we really, we took all areas, and we take all areas of religious life seriously in what we do.
Now, one of the things that I saw when I visited your website is that you do have a very explicit ecumenical appeal, that not only is it just you, the Episcopal priest who is now running this organization, but you have members of other faith traditions involved, Jews, Muslims, Catholics. How has that experience been? Have you found a lot of commonalities, or have there been big debates within, the confines of your organization about what constitutes the proper religious view of the environment?
It's been the advantage, I think, that we've got with this is that this topic remains new enough to most people in religious institutions that they don't know enough to have formed a prejudice about what other people believe about it. So there's an advantage to having it be a new topic on the block still. What I have found has been that that the ease of engaging different communities, different people from different traditions on this. As an example, in the wake of September 11th, it was understandably very difficult for us to get this topic onto the priority list of the Muslim community because they had more important priorities at that point, and that was completely understandable. It wasn't that they didn't care about it, it's just that they had a very substantial number of, if not life and death issues, really pressing issues to address.
Mm-hmm.
So, that now in recent years, the last 2 to 3 years, I've seen sort of a real uptick in engagement within the Muslim community. I think that that's in part because we're far enough out from September 11th now that there is more opportunity for engaging other issues within that community, and that's wonderful. What we saw was that with a denomination with the Roman Catholic tradition, the fact that I was Episcopalian, was a what added, I think, a level of complexity. I mean, the Roman Catholic community is a large and well-organized and multifaceted one, but within the existing power structure, it can be a little bit more complicated for Roman Catholic leadership to partner with leadership that's not Roman Catholic because there are sort of ongoing doctrinal concerns and that sort of thing.
So, were they still upset about that whole Henry VIII thing?
Well, I never heard it framed that way.
Okay.
To be frank, I think there's more concern within the Roman Catholic hierarchy about the fact that there are a number of environmental groups that speak very strongly about the importance of population control, and that creates real tensions within Roman Catholicism. So, I think that's where the tension emerges most starkly with that community. So different communities, different concerns, you look at, for instance, the Hindu community in the U.S., which is growing rapidly, as is the Muslim community, and, those communities behave in certain ways. I mean, they're sort of the, first, second generation immigrant experience where, their primary function as a religious community is to help preserve some of the traditions from the homeland, help people with assimilation into U.S. culture, help preserve some of their own you know, religious and institutional culture. And so taking on a topic that can be controversial, like the environment, sometimes isn't going to be their top priority because they want to save their resources sort of emotionally and intellectually to stay a little bit closer to home. So it's, you know, what I have seen clearly is that there is, without question, a consistent growth in the number of religious traditions and leaders within those traditions who believe that taking care of the environment is a priority. So there's no question in my mind that that trend is steadily headed upward, and I think it'll continue to head upward for the next several decades.
Mm-hmm. Now, your organization used to be called Partners for Environmental Quality, but now it's called Green Faith. How did that name come about?
As you noted earlier, Partners for Environmental Quality sort of has nothing to say about, you know, it's not a religious name at all.
Right.
And it came out of a conference that had been organized at Drew University by, in partnership with former Governor Tom Kaine, who was the head of Drew University for a number of years, where and this was something that Skip Bayless, Green Faith's founding board chair, was involved in, where leaders from the religious, business, environmental, academic sort of sectors of society came together to try to identify ways that these different sectors could become partners for environmental quality. So that was where the name came from originally. I felt strongly when I came on board that we needed to have a name that was explicitly religious and that would be very quickly recognizable as such. And so after considering a number of alternatives, we settled on Green Faith, and we've been really pleased with the name. It's a clear name. It's strong. It says quickly what we're about. You know, sometimes it gets confused with Greenpeace, but not too often, and it does the job.
Yeah, actually, after I was going through your website for several hours, it finally struck me that, oh, this sounds like Greenpeace. But it didn't strike me immediately that way. I thought Green Faith, oh, there's a faith group trying to bring stuff to the environment. So in that regard, a very effective name in terms of that. How are you guys funded now?
We get about 50 to 65% of our funding from private foundations, and that figure varies from year to year. We get about 20 to 30% from private donors and from faith-based sites. And we get the remainder, we get from different forms of earned income. We charge tuition for some of our programs. And we've also, you know, we have a program now that we're piloting in New Jersey in partnership with a solar developer through which we are identifying households that would like to go solar on their household, and we're able through this solar developer to offer them a chance to have the solar array installed on their home at no cost, and they then purchase the electricity that the system generates at a discount to what they'd normally pay their utility. And we basically operate on a commission basis with the, you know, we get paid a certain amount for every household that we identify. So we work. So there's a certain amount of stuff that we do that we generate revenues through, either through tuition fees or program-related income like that. So we piece it together from different sources.
And that gets me to some of the stuff that you do on a regular basis. You know, before you mentioned, Will, we go around and we preach you to different parishes. You've also mentioned that you run this fellowship program. And, you know, now you're also identifying households and parishes or church communities, religious communities, say, hey, you know, make yourself more energy efficient. I'm kind of a nuts and bolts guy in terms of stuff, and I always like to know what people are doing on a day-to-day basis. What does your day, your typical day look like? Are you mostly involved in fundraising? Are you thinking up new ideas like, oh, we should expand our program in this direction or Green Faith in that direction? What do you do on a daily basis?
So as an example of that, this morning when I first came in, I finished off a letter of inquiry to a foundation that we're seeking to get support from. So there's some fundraising work identified there. I spoke for an hour. We're planning a major event in Milwaukee this coming October, and I spent an hour on the phone with two local religious leaders in Milwaukee, walking through the the list of workshops and talking about what were our educational goals for this event, what skills and knowledge do we want people to walk out of that event with, and therefore what should the workshop topics be and who should the different presenters be. We're in the process of preparing a resource on water conservation, a sort of action guide for religious institutions. So I spent some time, you know, reviewing some stuff that some other folks on our staff have developed in an initial form on that. It's a range. I would say I split my time fairly evenly between the oversight and management and development of our programs and sort of fundraising and managing the overall organization. I mean, I also, this afternoon, I have to talk with our IT provider because we need a new server. So
Changing the light bulbs and stuff like that. I talked to a number of clergy throughout my research things, and they tell me a lot of stuff we do between the Sundays is actually mundane stuff like that, but it has to get done.
Yep,
it has
absolutely.
To get done.
And it's, you know, later this afternoon, I'm meeting with the person on our staff who's overseeing our outreach on the solar project that I mentioned, and we're going to go over. We've got about 15 or 20 events planned at faith-based sites around New Jersey to promote that program, so we'll go over the calendar of those events and make sure that we've got things properly organized for that. So it's a range of different things.
Now, speaking about outreach, who tends to be your target audience for what you're doing? Are you aimed at established churches that are already out there? Are you looking at lay communities, or are you trying to just even take this into the secular realm and saying, here we are, we can help people, whether or not you go to church or connected with a church?
We find that our audience sort of breaks down in two basic directions. One is established religious institutions, houses of worship, faith-based schools primarily. And they're the audience for whom we design most of our programs, just because they have an organized infrastructure. We know, having been a parish priest for 10 years, having lots of colleagues who are ordained, we have a good sense of what works in organized religious communities. And so that's our primary audience. And that's the audience through which we're able to have an impact. What I've found consistently, however, is that there's a reasonable percentage of people who consider themselves sort of members of Green Faith and part of Green Faith who are not members of an organized religious community, but they care deeply about taking care of the environment, and they believe that there is a spiritual, moral dimension to that, and we become, in some sense, a landing place for their feelings about that. The people who already may well belong to the National Wildlife Federation or the Sierra Club or whatever, but they also feel that there's a spiritual, an explicitly spiritual moral dimension to things, and they feel that Green Faith articulates that in a way that secular environmental groups don't. So I would say, majority of our audience is people who are members of organized religious communities, and then a secondary audience, as I just described. And we also try to make our voice heard in the public square, so to speak, about what we believe as people of faith and what we believe religious traditions teach about the environment. So we are active participants in, any number of sort of public conversations about things, but our primary audience is religious community.
Now, do you find some religious communities to be more receptive to your message than others? I mean, people know you're an Episcopal priest, so are mainline denominations more receptive to what you're talking about? Have you drawn in some more of the conservative evangelical groups, Pentecostals, Mormons, etc.?
It's been a little bit easier for us to engage mainline Protestant, Reform and Conservative Jewish and Reconstructionist Jewish communities. The Unitarian community is very receptive. We're finding an increasing level of interest within Muslim communities, and we've got our first partnership with a Hindu organization, also Hindu America Seva Charities. I would say it starts with on the sort of structural level with those denominations and those partners. But within those larger networks, there are any number of places that really, for them the environment is not a priority. And then there are some that are, and there are also institutions within the evangelical community, within more traditionally conservative denominations or religious groups for whom the environment is a priority. So it, you know, what I emphasize to folks is that the religious environmental movement is still extremely young, and the level of market penetration, so to speak, is quite low. I think what's changed from a decade ago is that we in most cases, we don't need to argue that people ought to care about this as a religious issue. It's now a question of, you know, it's now really sort of the question of implementation. How do you give people the tools that they can use in the midst of their very busy lives to have a meaningful experience and do something that's genuinely useful for the environment?
Yeah, that is true. And I'm also starting to sense that the inroads being made today are not just amongst communities, but it's a generational issue, that you see a lot more younger evangelicals who are interested in environmental stuff as compared to the, you know, old white haired guys who are on the podiums right now preaching stuff. Do you get a sense of that? Is there a generational change or issue involved in all this?
Very much so. I think that, I mean, what I've seen in the work, and we're going to be doing a significant amount of work this year in evangelical communities in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Virginia, because we want to reach out to those younger evangelicals who clearly believe that protecting the environment and addressing poverty, both domestically and globally, are the defining moral issues of our time, unlike their elders in the sort of previous generation of evangelical leaders who identified issues related to abortion and gay marriage and stuff like that as the sort of the top tier moral issues. So there's no question that there's a generational aspect to it.
Well, you mentioned both environmental issues and poverty here, and I just want to switch gears and talk a little bit more theoretically on an issue that's of great academic interest to me, because I study political economy and economics as well as religion. You know, it's pretty common in a lot of environmental circles, especially secular environmental circles, to want to quickly pull a trigger for government regulation when any problem arises. And this is also true, I would say, for poverty or other social issues. For instance, you know, if there's a problem that arises with water quality in the lake, most people want to quickly turn to the government and say, hey, let's make a law, let's make a regulation that fixes this. That seems to make sense because that just fixes the problem. But one of the more unique features of green faith, and you've hinted at this in our earlier discussion here, and I want to talk about is this kind of market-based approach to solving environmental problems. But before we get into that, I have a bigger theologically rooted question that I want to get to. You know, to what extent do we Christians abdicate our own ethical obligations to our fellow humans by basically shoving off problems to the government to be solved? Have you given any thought to that?
Yeah, I mean, it drives me a little bit nuts sometimes, because I, by definition, to some degree, spend a fair amount of time with liberal religious leaders, and you know, they're wonderful about speaking about the importance of protecting the environment and advocating for society to do something about it. But then when one asks them about their own sort of personal behavior, it doesn't sort of add up. I mean, if they believe that climate change is an issue, they're not buying carbon offsets. They're not. And I mean, I'm not naive about that stuff. I know that collective policy stuff in the end is a major part of how society gets shaped, but I believe that at an early stage of social change in any area of activity, that individual behavior change matters a lot. So, you know, I think that I would say two things. I think that Christians or people of all faith abdicate their moral responsibility, first of all, by not prioritizing the environment as something that they believe is of moral significance. So I think that that's the first piece. I mean, I think we're making progress on that, but it really is vital for people, I think, to come to realize that, that their consumption and our consumption as a society and our use of natural resources has real moral significance. I think the second piece is to recognize that, that culture matters deeply. And is oftentimes more powerful than any kind of regulation. It's not that regulation isn't important. It's just that it's a necessary part of the picture. And I'm a big believer that original sin is the one Christian belief that's been empirically proven. So I think that we're naive to think that the people are just going to be nice or virtuous on their own, because they're not a lot of the time. None of us are, and it's foolish to think so. But I also think that there is a tremendous need for within the sectors that we work with, for individual people to take on new ways of living and new ways of behaving, and also to recognize that there's a pretty long history, not only in this country, but certainly in this country, of very important private land stewardship and environmental stewardship. And to talk about the environment as though it's only about government action, runs the risk of really, damaging that legacy and not keeping that legacy alive in a healthy way.
Yeah, when we were talking a bit earlier about your funding sources, I noted that all of them were from private sources, either private foundations, private individuals making donations, or as you mentioned, you get some revenue from tuition or finding houses to put in solar panels and things like that. So do you work at all with government, so either at the local or federal level?
Yep, and we've had a whole different range of kinds of relationships with government. We have received government funding at times, both on the state and federal level. We got a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to do outreach and education on solar power. We've gotten grants from the state of New Jersey, the Board of Public Utilities, to do education within the faith sector on the importance of greenhouse gas emissions reduction. So we've gotten government funding. We also have done advocacy, sort of traditional legislative advocacy. So for instance, now we have been encouraging the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee to get the Safe Chemicals Act, new sort of chemical legislation that would overhaul the Toxic Substances Control Act, to move that forward, because we believe that that's of significance and really important. And we've also sued the government. I mean, we were involved in a lawsuit related to our environmental justice work several years ago, where the Army Corps of Engineers was dredging, doing some dredging activity in Newark Bay, in a manner that was distributing a lot of toxic chemicals around the community, and we didn't think that they'd taken proper care to safeguard the community. So we have received funding from the government. We have, we advocate. I participate in different, I've been on different sort of panels, advisory panel. I'm on the New Jersey Environmental Justice Advisory Council. So, we've had a range of different relationships with government, both on a state and federal level.
But one of the things that really attracted me to your organization and caught my eye is that you do work at the grassroots level, and you're not just a big hammer, let's get legislation to change everything. And, as I mentioned at the start of the podcast, I read about your organization in a magazine that's published regularly by the Property and Environmental Research Center, also known as PERC, out in Bozeman, Montana. And I should give a big shout out here to Paul Schwenensen, who wrote the initial article and pointed me in your direction. So thank him for writing that article. And for those of folks out who are listening in our audience that don't know anything about PERC, it is a think tank that promotes something that is known as free market environmentalism, basically trying to solve or find private solutions to public problems. And what PERC does is similar to your organization, is they sponsor a number of fellowships and programs throughout the year that bring scholars and students and entrepreneurs out to Bozeman to learn about this free market environmental approach. Now, you and one of the other members of your staff, Stacy Keenely, I think.
Keenely, yep. Mm-hmm.
Happen to have participated in these programs, something known as the Enviropreneur Institute, I think back in 2007 and again in 2010. Tell us a little bit about that program, what it sought to accomplish, and what you learned from that.
I think, it was a very interesting and very useful experience. And what it did essentially was to talk about market-based and sort of private and market-based mechanisms that existed to help protect environmental quality and how that could work. So everything from, how can you create a system whereby if a water conservation group in the West wants to increase the flow of water in certain rivers over time, that rather than having a regulation to do that, they actually identify funding sources to purchase the water rights from the owners of those rights. So they're essentially paying to, you know, they're buying the right to have that water remain in the river. Everything, what we got from it, what I got from it that I found very valuable was the real recognition that incentives matter. That if you're going to try to get people to do what's right for the environment, that they need to be incentivized to do so. And so, you know, one of the ways that that's affected our programs is that we always, whenever we create a new program, we try to identify the ways in which that program can create benefits not only environmentally, but can create benefits for the house of worship that's implementing it. So whether it's through saving money or attracting new or younger members, you know, we think about the fact that people are always too busy. They've got a lot of time pressure. They're only going to choose to do things that benefit them very directly and that represent something about their self-interest. And so, you know, that PERC was very good at teaching about that and it sort of, you know, challenging us to think about that and, you know, to think about how do you create a situation where people are incentivized to do the right thing as opposed to being told to do it when you're going to sort of deal with all of the natural resistance that comes along with that.
Yeah, no, that works a lot with me too, is that you can, you know, tell me all the good and moral reasons that I should be more caring of the environment. But when you tell me I can cut 15% off my electric bill, I'm like, okay, I'm listening to you now. So I got to dip into a little bit of a stereotype here about the Episcopal clergy, because you kind of come from a liberal mainline tradition, and that's not one that nowadays people necessarily think about when they think about free market approaches to solutions. So for you, did you have any skepticism about going into PERC and learning about this kind of stuff? And
yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And you know, frankly, I did have skepticism, not so much about, I mean, my dad worked on Wall Street sort of before the current era of Wall Street, which, you know, I think is has changed. I think there have been real changes over the last 30 years. But, you know, so I had a sense of and a comfort level with sort of the corporate and, you know, business and financial markets approach to reality and never saw it as the be all and end all of everything. But, you know, I mean, there's enormous benefits that have been created for folks through, you know, through market-based capitalist systems. I mean, I just think that that's undeniable. And has it caused problems? Absolutely. But has it brought benefits? You know, you betcha. So I went in with that openness. My greater reservation about PERC was that it you know was on the sort of culture war approach to things. I mean, I really, you know, I frankly am, you know, I was disappointed that I found PERC being fairly friendly to folks who were, you know, climate skeptics, which I think is a, you know, I think that's a very dangerous kind of mindset to sort of cultivate or to sort of work with at this point. I mean, I know that there are people who believe that, but I had skepticism and concern about that piece of the picture. But, you know, I mean, look, I've worked with religious denominations all my life. I have some significant concerns about them too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, you have to sort of get off your ideological high horse a little bit, I think, with some of this stuff. And the thing that was very valuable about PERC was that it was intellectually stimulating, and it, you know, we learned a lot of very useful stuff about methods, about, you know, how to do stuff, how to get stuff done. And I think that coming out of the, you know, a lot of that knowledge within society about how to gather and manage and organize resources, human and otherwise, the business sector is the place where a lot of the best thinking is happening about those issues in our society at this point in time. And you know, PERC, I think, does a really good job of helping people from the environmental sector get connected with that.
Have you found it to be a hard sell to any of your colleagues in the faith-based environmental community that say, hey, you know, it's all about the moral issues and changing culture, but you come back and say, hey, I found something at PERC about incentives. Do you find that a hard sell?
No, because I find that people respond to it. I mean, the bottom line is that it's, you know, it's the way that, that an awful lot of religious institutional life happens already. I mean, people may not call it a sort of incentive-based approach, but my clergy colleagues are always trying to figure out ways to incentivize their members to do certain things. And, you know, whether it's, I mean, oftentimes the incentives are social in nature because religious institutions don't, you know, often pay people for certain behaviors, but, you know, that doesn't mean that it's not an incentive-based approach. So I think that, you know, I think that what I find, and again, this sort of happens at the ideological, I mean, there's just this big ideological split in this country at this point where there's a, you know, a lot of the liberal community is, you know, corporate sector is a four-letter word and, you know, you just can't go there and have a, and on the, you know, right-wing side of the equation, environmentalist is a four-letter word. And it's, there's this sort of really fairly useless kind of deadlock that's going on with this stuff that in the end doesn't result in anything useful for anybody, frankly. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So I guess to some degree I'm increasingly skeptical of what I would call an ideologue approach to environmental concerns, whether it's on the right or on the left. It seems pretty clear to me that the business sector, we need the business sector if we're going to create a healthy, flourishing environment. There's simply no other way around it. It's the most influential sector on the face of the planet. That's only going to grow in the years ahead. And if we don't have millions of green entrepreneurs finding ways to scale their technologies up to a massive scale, we're lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming near to the end of our interview here, and I always like to give my guests the opportunity to, think in the big picture perspective on things. And from your experience of working within the faith-based environmental movement for 20 years or so as an executive director and as a volunteer and as somebody who's thought about this quite a bit, what things have you taken away from your experience? And in addition to that, because we have a number of young listeners who listen to this program, college students and homeschoolers, what advice might you give to the next generation coming through the ranks thinking about these issues?
I think the first thing that I'd say is that if any of your listeners are people who have, valued the outdoors, spent time outdoors and found God or an important spiritual experience out there, but haven't seen organized faith communities willing to affirm that or recognize the significance of those experiences, I want to say those experiences are important because I think that a lot of people have their most important experiences, spiritual experiences outdoors, and these are experiences that are of real significance for people's identity, you know, for who they are and what they believe in at the deepest level. And so I think on that level, you know, my message would be that those are vitally important experiences and learn from them and stick with them. And I think the other piece that I would say is that if people are members of organized religious or spiritual communities, believe in the importance of what that community can do in terms of helping this more environmentally healthy culture emerge. Find ways to integrate these themes into what you do at your synagogue, at your church, at your mosque, at your temple, and find ways to understand these actions of environmental protection and conservation from a religious perspective. I mean, it's interesting in that all of the world's great religions recognize the importance of restraint in the use of material resources as a sign of moral maturity. You know, there are a lot of differences between religions, but none of them says that, you know, the purpose of life is to consume as much as you possibly can. I mean, there's, and it's not that consumption is bad, far from it, but, you know, recognize that in restraint we grow. And think about how, you know, what is the meaning that has for us as a larger society about how we kind of reinvent ourselves to live well in relationship to the planet.
Well, I, being an outdoor enthusiast myself, am completely down with that message, and I will be taking this to my faith-based communities that I interact with as well. So, Fletcher, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. It's been a wonderful, enlightening, and enjoyable interview.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if
you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.